The January 11th Joint Interim Task Force on the Texting of the Sexual Assault Forensic Evidence Kits to order. And Josh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're going to start today with an update on the safe kit testing. I think Captain Gardner and Rod were going to handle that for us.
I'll be short. Shall I go first?
Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the good news is we have everybody online. We don't have all of the analysts through all of the training, but we all have all of them through enough training so that they can work particular modules. So we have sort of an assembly line system working now. And we are producing or processing many more kits than we're getting in. So the backlog is larger than it has been, principally because we've had a big dump over the last 60 days or so as police agencies clear out the remaining backlog in their evidence lockers. But our capacity now is substantially higher than the rate of work coming into the system, so we're in great shape. And that's about it.
Good. That's great news.
It is great news.
Nicely done.
That's
great.
So, Madam Chair, and committee members, Rod Underhill. Another update in close consultation with Oregon State Police and Alex here and others, as it relates to the backlog of safe kits as defined by District Attorney New York. And so the reason I say it that way is what that translates into is a pre-existing untested kit pre-existing to January 1st of 2016, if I'm remembering right, 2015. So within that definition, there, as you committee members no doubt recall, Multnomah County, Lane County, and Marion County endeavored with assistance of resources, in other words, money, to address the backlog as it existed in those counties. At the time, and we're going back a little bit into history, a couple of years, just by way of foundational, at the time, we estimated, the three counties estimated that cumulative total to be in the neighborhood of 3,000 safe kits. We knew that with approximately the $2 million grant from DANY, and the contract that we had undertaken with Sorensen, that we would be able to attest essentially that 3,000. I say that by way of backlog because, as it's turned out, as we have endeavored upon this, and then have all three counties have sent their kits now to Sorensen, that number, instead of being 3,000, turned out to be just north of 2,600. I think specifically 2,610 between the three counties. And so that left two things. One, capacity by Sorensen to do some more testing if there were kits to be tested. And two, additional resources in the form of money available still left over as a result of unspent from DANY. So two things occurred essentially. I'm trying to give you the Reader's Digest, but staff and some of the staff are here reached out to DANY to ask our grant monitor if we would be allowed to spend some of that additional, those additional resources, money, left over on other untested safe kits that might, that would exist in the state of Oregon, and the answer, simply put, was yes. We contacted Sorensen to ask essentially the same question from a business standpoint, from a resources that they had, the ability to test these untested kits. Could they take on more in addition to our 2610, understanding that we thought it originally it was going to be 3,000. Again, the answer was yes. So with those two things in place, I've had a number of conversations with other prosecutors' offices and such from around the state. I know others have had additional conversations trying to understand what is still remains untested under the DANY definition, that pre- January of 2015 definition, and we got a strong handle on about what that number is. And then we are working, and I'm saying we, here later today we're going to hear from Tara Gardner, one of the deputies from my office, and Senior Deputy Amity Gert. They've been doing most of the legwork as it relates to this, but reaching out to the jurisdictions, having conversations with not just with prosecutors' offices necessarily, but law enforcement agencies, to facilitate the testing of what will be when it's all done, I think, with this project, and give us another couple weeks to kind of lock it down. But what will be hundreds of remaining safe kits. So here in a couple of weeks, we'll have a better handle on what hundreds means. It's going to be north of 200. It's already, we've accumulated, I think it was 210, I was told a few minutes ago. Another couple of weeks, that number will rise, that we'll be able to pay for with Danny money through Sorensen, of course, pursuant to the system that we worked out, those results and such return to the Oregon State Police for review and appropriate consideration and such. And that's where conversations with the Oregon State Police and Captain Gardner here have taken place, a number of them. But we, I think, in summary, we all view that as good news as we endeavor to address the backlog that exists. And we've already, as we've talked about this group, with the law change surrounding Melissa's law, we've reduced greatly, if not eliminated, the possibility of in the future accumulation of a backlog. So I hope I didn't leave anything out, at least in the form of a summary, but I think that's very, very good news for the state of Oregon.
I would agree, and good work by all. Thank you so much for all getting it done as quickly as possible, which is an extended period of time. Sadly, I can't say that this is ever going to go away completely, but we're making some great strides, and I appreciate all the work. So with that, shall we move on to the sexual assault kit management system? Susan and Ed?
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you and welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Susan Lehman. I'm with the Portland Police Bureau. I'm their program coordinator in the Sex Crimes Unit. And beside me is Ed Reeve. He's the IT supervisor for the Police Bureau.
So I kind of manage the application development team for the Portland Police Bureau.
So we developed SAMS as a tracking tool for our SACI grant that we got back in 2015. And originally we used $100,000 of forfeiture money to design the database, which is probably, it's grown 60%, which you'll see today, than what we originally started with. At the time, George Burke was the commander of the Sex Crimes Unit, and his instructions were, we're going to spend all this money, we're going to give it to any law enforcement agency that wishes to have it, free of charge. And so, to that end, we have done that. We have given it to Austin PD, Vegas, Duluth, Mobile, Fayetteville, Memphis, and coming online this spring will be Charlotte, North Carolina, Flint, Michigan, and the four counties in Hawaii.
Wow.
And we're not taking any visitors with us to Hawaii. Everybody asks. So, and I've probably given this demonstration a couple dozen times, so I tend to speak fast. But we're going to go through what we actually track in the system, who we track, and application overview. The application is set up in pages or tabs, so it's easy to find the information you need quickly if you're just looking for a small bit of data. We also are going to show two applications that are in development right now, which is barcode tracking off a mobile device and a victim portal, which Ed will talk about those because they're still in development. So the features we have is an initial dashboard that displays vital information, and it can be changed, and items can be added to it or subtracted from it, so you see the view that you wish to see. Evidence tracking, we have automatic SACI and Danny tracking for the two grants that have propelled this project forward. All the fields you will see in SAMS are defined by the individual agency or users. There are no set fields in there. Any agency can change the fields to whatever they like for their jurisdiction. It has a case management function, and it will have automatic email and text notifications to both victims and investigators. And like I said, the barcode tracking and the victim portal. So Portland received $850,000 in federal grants to develop what we're calling SAMS 2.0. So some of the things we talk about, like the automatic notification, is part of the SAMS 2.0 project. So we track everyone. We track the suspects, registered sex offenders, your peepers, creepers, and exposers, and traffickers. We collect over 200 points of data, including detailed case information, information that is not normally kept in a records management system at a department, but is in the heart or the narrative of the police report. We collect victim information, suspect information, all evidence tracking, investigation, prosecution, and adjudication information. So basic case information is your case number, the location, the date, the time, the offense, what unit this case is assigned to. And that can automatically populate from an agency's RMS system. And then we also go to the nitty-gritty. We can track the statute of limitations. Was there a witness present? Were there any weapons? Was there violence used? Was it a campus assault? Was it a gang assault? Was it forwarded to an MDT unit? Was it a drug or alcohol facilitated attack? And was social networking used in some way to lure the victim to the suspect? And what location type is there? Not the physical address, but was it an abandoned building? Did it happen in a backyard, behind a dumpster? Those kind of nuances are all collected into SAMS. And in Oregon, we're allowed pretext phone calls. Did the investigator use that method? And if so, was it helpful? So this is a, can you see it okay? Half of a screenshot of the first case page. And it will show related case information up here, victim name and suspect. You're looking at our demonstration, which we use the cartoon characters, Pepe Le Pew and Penelope Huey's always after. These first six items would come over automatically from an RMS if an agency decides to do that. You can use SAMS without a connection to your RMS. So here we track the number of perpetrators. Any of these large multi-selectional drop-down boxes and every other, I'm used to doing this on the live database, so I want to click that, that drop-down menu open, but oops. All the drop-down menus, like I said, are user-defined. So when we install in a jurisdiction, they are blank. And the users decide what they're going to populate those fields with. We leave some in that we think they're kind of like force, use of force. Did they use force? Were they incapacitated? We'll leave those in, but the agency can clear them out. What is the relationship to the suspect? Are they acquaintance? Are they a family member? If they're a family member, then the familial relationship box will open up, and they can select from that. Location type, social networking. And again, gang, campus, and alcohol facilitated. If you select the yes box, then the corresponding drop-down menus open up. And we normally download the alcohol establishments out of the agency's RMS, so they don't have to be hand input. And because SAMS is originally developed to work with the grant, so it is can use historical cases along with current cases, we do have an original case disposition box. This is the second half of the first case screen. We have here a working group or task force. If you are using a grant or you have an MDT, you can send the case to the working group, and then whatever their decision was, you can mark here and track. And investigations, of course, we list the investigator, the date it was assigned, what sort of investigative activities they did. Did they interview? Did they get electronic surveillance? Did they do a phone dump? And the pretext phone call, and then how was that case cleared? And we leave in the uniform crime reporting clearance codes that are set by the FBI. So most people know UCR. So those are pre-populated in there along with the clearance definitions for those clearance codes. When was the case to the DA's office? Yes or no? And what date was that? And you'll see on the dashboard, we actually track when we send cases over to the DA's office and how many days they've been waiting. Once the DA has been assigned, we track who the DA is, who their advocate is, the DA case number, the DA decision, and the date of that decision. If you select rejected in SAMS, it'll bring to open reasons for rejection. For victim information, again, the basics, the name, address, race, gender, date of birth, home address, phone number. We also collect gender at time of crime because Portland's had several victims that have changed their gender on these historical cases. Social media pages, domicile, are they living in a home or supportive housing, or are they in foster care? That way we can hopefully track and be able to go back to some supportive housing and say you have a large number of your clientele that are being victimized and see if we can offer some remedy there. We track disability, addiction, and mental health. And for those three, they have to be either self-disclosed by the victim or on a police on a medical report. We don't allow investigators or police officers to guess. They have to be documented or self-disclosed by the victim. So this is a first half of the victim page. As you can see, you can put a photo in of the victim. SAMS is developed so you can have multiple victims per case. You can have multiple suspects per case. We offer, is the victim still alive? So if they've been deceased, you can collect the deceased box. Their general information, date of birth, first, last name, address, email address. This has come in handy during electronic notification, what branch of the military they are in, and victim ID numbers, driver's license, Social Security, or state ID numbers. And of course, their phone numbers. Most of this information would come over from an agency's RMS. We have a social media block here in case an investigator would like to take over their social media account. We can collect that information here. And what domicile they were living in at the time of crime and care facility name. The addictions box is multi-selectional, and disability and mental health is a radio button, yes or no, with a description. So, SAMS has very few free text boxes, but those are two of them right there. Does this victim have additional agency sex cases? You can add those there. Are they a minor victim of sex trafficking? And the grants ask these questions along with an audit that Portland underwent in 2014. Was your victim located? Did you attempt to contact them? And are they participating in your investigation? And what was the method of first contact? So you can track to see if your method of first contact is actually having results or you need to change that. Suspect information is pretty much the same. The suspect page is developed into four parts: the suspect basic information, prosecution history, and incident detail page. And the first part of this page is almost identical to the victim page, except we do have SID and FBI number to find because you can query those numbers in SAMS. And the second half of the page is also very much the same, except we've added property crime conviction and DV conviction, which was part of the grants because research shows that these sexual predators are also participating in property crime and DV crimes as well. And then at the very bottom, we ask if they've been interviewed, and if that was successful, and if they had an admission or a confession, and additional sex cases for this agency. Under the suspect page is also prosecution. So this would be prosecution for the current case that you're looking at, what charges were brought against this individual on this case, and the severity and disposition of those charges, and the level, felony or misdemeanor. Did they get a sex offender package? And if so, what was the status of that package? And the final disposition, along with the disposition date, and sentence type and probation in the number of months. And was the conviction appealed? And if so, what was the appellate court decision? But the last question is, did this kit result in prosecution? Is a psychic grant question. The history tab is mainly a synopsis of an individual's criminal history, and you can upload a PDF. Most agencies, including Portland, we just put in their sex crimes that they've had, any felony person crimes that they've had, so we can keep track of those. And the last used to be called the Peepers Creepers and Exposures page, because you can add anything else to a sexual assault that doesn't have a named person to it. So if you have some exposure in a certain part of town, and you're watching them progress, this is the page that does it. We renamed it to the incident detail page. So vehicle, make, model, color. Those are all the standard NCIC codes that are used across the nation. So agents, those codes we do leave in when we send SAMs to another jurisdiction. License plate, did they use a car for hire? Are they a driver for Uber or a local taxi company or Lyft? Body scars, birthmarks, eye color, hair color, tattoos. Again, those are all the standard NCIC codes that most law enforcement agencies are used to. Do they have piercings? What kind of clothing were they wearing? Were they wearing a hat or a mask? And what's their genital description? So that five-second view a woman gets when she gets flashed in the park. And were they left or right-hand dominant for serial masturbators? And did they have a scent to them? A lot of victims will report that they smelled like alcohol, or they had a certain scent to their body. So we track that here as well. And what kind of activity were they engaging in before the attack? Were they loitering? Were they riding their bike by? Were they jogging by? What kind of verbiage did they use? Again, we track the incident location here. Were they using a recording device? Were they using their camera? Were they upskirting? Were they using a video camera? And the action, were they fondling, masturbating, things like that? And did they ejaculate? This box is yes, no, or they used a condom. And the 33 most common fetishes by the American Psychological Association. We also track human trafficker information. So if you have a victim that is a prostitute, and she has been victimized in a hotel room by a John, and she's willing to give you the trafficker information, we can track that in SAMHSA as well. Sorry about that. So the trafficker information page is basically the same name, date of birth, race, gender, phone numbers. What kind of social media accounts do they use? Are they using Backpage? Are they using Grindr or Tinder, or any of those to solicit business? What kind of recruitment method do they have? Are the victims U.S. born? And if not, what country are they from? What kind of violence is used? Are the girls also being forced to do other sorts of sexualized labor, such as stripping? And what kind of evidence do we track? We track all the evidence that you can ever submit to the crime lab. You can track in SAMHSA. And we also track if it's being paid by a certain grant and the hospital the exam was done at, along with the nurse's name and the number of hours between when the assault happened and when the kit was actually taken. It'll be interesting to see if there is a bell curve to that or a straight drop-off point when we finally get enough data in. Did we collect consensual partner standards or suspect standards? So this is the first half of the evidence page, where we have the grant type and the property receipt and the date the kit was inventoried, the state crime lab number, the private lab number, the FBI lab number, the private lab name that you're using, the evidence location, the batch number, the date the batch was sent in, the date and time of the exam, the hospital, the nurse. Is this a Jane Doe kit? And do you have the sexual assault kit paperwork? Why was this kit not previously tested if it's a historical kit? And if you're not submitting it today, why are you not submitting it today? Consensual partner standards. And is this a rush at the crime lab? And then we have this property box where you can actually list out individual pieces of property or for some records management systems, that information can come from that. The second half page shows the DNA box, which asks, is this sample eligible for CODIS? If so, what's the CODIS upload date? Once you get a CODIS hit, was it an offender or forensic? Was it a warm or cold hit? Is he a sex offender, a non-sex offender? The CODIS charges that are associated with that hit, and does this hit match the offender? Does it match another case in your database? Or did it exonerate your suspect altogether? And because CODIS sometimes changes their rules, every once in a while they get kicked out, and so we track what date your specimen was removed out of CODIS. We also have, if you box to release to another agency, in large metropolitan areas, you collect kits from all over. People come to hospitals and from Salem, or they're here on vacation, or they come home from vacation and the crime occurred in Las Vegas. Are we going to release that kit to another agency? And if so, who are we releasing it to, and who authorized the release and their badge number? Same with authorizing destruction. When are you disposing of it? What's your reason? Who's authorizing it? And was your victim notified? So for Oregon, if I were to authorize destruction in Portland, a big red message comes up and says, wait a minute, you have to wait 60 years before you can destroy this kit. Was the safe kit tested to completion, and the date of that? And then this is what it looks like once we get the tests in. So this first one here is a kit that went to biology, the date it was sent, the date it was completed, and that is not actually a crime lab report, but it would show like that. And then DNA. The kit, it went into CODIS, the dates, and another crime lab report would be there. And we have penile swabs and clothing added here as well. And you can have an infinite number of evidence and testing that goes in this section here. We also provide advocacy case management by showing the advocate assigned, the date the victim was first contacted, or located, the confidentiality letter that Portland has, resources given, crime victims compensation, are they using a victims rights law center, total number of client contacts, case notes, and important contact information. So this is a sample of what the advocate page would look at, because again, SAMS deals with current and historical cases. We have a previous advocate and the advocate currently assigned. There's a place here for advocacy to close their case out, contact box if they're using a social service contact. They have a case manager and you want to put that information here. They're homeless and the only phone number you have is for the mother. You can put that information in there. What kind of resources were given out so we can provide to our community partners, how many food boxes we gave out to sex crimes victims, and are they using crime victims compensation, the date of the release of information. Some of the agencies that have SAMs use nonprofit advocates, so that was an important field for them to have. Are they using a Victims' Rights Law Center? If so, which one, and who's the attorney there? And then the advocate notes. So SAMs is developed, and Ed'll talk more about it, but each one of these tabs or pages here can be locked out. So for agencies that use nonprofit advocates that are funded under VAWA, we can lock law enforcement out of the advocate tab, and vice versa. You can lock the whole agency out of the document tab if you like. So I'll let Ed talk about the dashboard.
Yeah, so this is our live dashboard that basically it gives us a live view of everything that's been entered in SAMS. So all the cases, the number of cases, the number of CODIS hits for cases that happen in a certain year. On the left side, we keep at the bottom there, we keep track of all the cases that have been sent to the DA, what's the DA number, the DA assigned, and how many days since it was sent. So we can keep track of what's the elapsed time. We keep track also of an average average number of days for all those cases that the case was sent to the DA and it's still pending. We also created a tree map. We did it for location type, and it's kind of just kind of gives you a view what are the most common location type, for example, where sexual assault take place. And this with the data we have currently, it looks like residences. That's the big green box. We'll be adding additional ones to look at different metrics. So, well, this one is a live dashboard in phase two. We'll be looking at more kind of analysis tools to analyze the data, find different trends, and what a relationship, where sexual assaults happen, and maybe get to the point where we can do some predictions on what are the most common places or individuals that there are high risk that fall in certain category. Also, the dashboard allows you to do drill down. So you can look at information, for example, for a year. You can drill down to quarters. You can drill down to months. You can look at days. Very, very flexible. And just kind of add what Susan showed you for the data entry. You know, we kind of built it to be very easy to use. So a lot of things are just easy to select from drop downs, radio buttons, very easy to use, kind of prevent making mistakes. So we don't let people just enter whatever data. So for example, when we pick location type, it comes from a list and allows us to do these analysis and dashboards and have good data to show rather than just letting people just enter different values. The advanced search, what Susan showed is you basically work with a single case. The search allows you to do either a free-form search on a certain term. You're looking for a person, you're looking for certain tattoo or piercing, or that's all you have. So you can just type what you're looking for, and it will basically give you the list of cases that match that criteria. You can do multiple parameters, so you can, for example...
you won't be able to tell,
That's okay, I know the data. Yeah, you can, for example, put, gender, you can put, where the crime happened, what district, different, what type of offense, and it will just filter to those. You can do multiple filters at the same time. And I guess kind of not easy to show in here, but once you get the case information, each one of those rows can expand, and you can look at the victim, you can look at the suspect, you can look at the evidence, all from the search, all from this screen by itself. So it's pretty complex, pretty comprehensive, kind of meant to when you're researching and you just have a limited amount of information to work with, and you just basically narrow it down. You just type partial information, partial case numbers, and it will just basically filter it down. And when you get to the case you're looking for, then you can focus on just that case. The administration side, basically everything that's in a drop down, or you can select from a list. We built a maintenance screen for it, so that way the users themselves, or the person that manages SAMS, can make changes, make updates, without having require somebody from IT or programming change. Or I think there's probably over 50 or 60 screens that basically allows the person that manages SAMS. To put in, whatever location type, whatever offenses, test types, they manage, the complete application. And that way we're able to share with other jurisdictions, other states, and they can put in their own data, their own whatever value they want to put in their dropdowns, and without requiring, IT or any programming change. to get it done. SAM for managing users, we use what's called role-based security. So for each user, you can restrict what they have access to. If you want them to only see the case information, you can lock down the victim information, the evidence, and they can only see what you want to give them access to.
We also allow for adult and juvenile expungements. So in Oregon, juvenile expungement is a destruction of the record. So if you select a case for juvenile expungement, it totally wipes it out of the database. Adult record sealing hides it in the database, and that is one function you do need IT for, somebody else to verify that you actually have a court order to reestablish the data in the database.
Okay, so this is what we're working on for phase two. We want to have more accurate kit tracking instead of relying on somebody entering the information and telling you, okay, this is where the kit is. We're building a mobile app for iPhones and Android phones that can be used by any law enforcement individual or to scan the barcode on the kit from the time it gets it's collected at the hospital all the way, when it gets picked up by an officer, goes to the property room, goes to the lab. At each step, we basically can scan the barcode. We can collect the location where it is. We have the ability to take photos, collect signatures. When you get shipped, you can also scan the shipping label from a UPS or a FedEx or a USPS, and we'll store that information. We'll also retrieve the complete tracking from FedEx or UPS. It will basically tell us, where the kit is, when it arrived. If it was shipped to a lab, we'll know when it arrived. And the same when it gets shipped back from the lab, we'll track, when it was shipped, when it was received, who received it, and we'll keep a complete. I think you go to the next. So this is when, each time you get transferred, we scan the barcode and record who it was transferred to.
And if you don't have a barcode, you can use the kit ID number that comes on every safe kit to track it as well.
I have search capability. If you know the case number, you can search by case number and get the complete tracking information.
You talk faster than I move. There we go.
Yeah, so this is the complete chain of custody from the time the kit was initiated and the same nurse did the exam and there's a kit to when it was collected by the evidence officer, went to the to the lab or to the property room, and with the date, and for each one of those there's more detail on who collected it, when they collected it, their signature, etc. The last piece is the victim portal. We've been getting a lot of requests to provide a victim portal, and we kind of struggled, how do we provide a victim portal in an anonymous way that can provide some information. And we've been kind of trying to find what's the best way. Of course, we don't want to give, a lot of detailed information. That's kind of for law enforcement. So we kind of in the process of creating a public site that can be used by victims to query the information anonymously just by knowing the kit ID. So if you know the kit number, you can put the kit number and gives you information about that kit. There'll be no seizures information, no identifying information, just, this is when, it was collected, this is when it was sent to the lab, this is when it was sent to the property room. If it's it was sent to the DA, and that's about it. That's the information that's going to collect. There'll be absolutely no names. Actually, it's going to be completely separate database, so there's no risk that you know, any of the information, you know, it could be retrieved. It's going to be completely separate. It's not going to be related to SAMS. It's going to be separate basic information to allow the victims themselves, if they wish, to get information in an anonymous way. And it's going to be mainly public information that's going to be available. And it's, you know, it's not going to have who it is for, what it was for, just numbers, a kit number, and the tracking information related to that kit number. Kind of a little bit more technical. I'm not sure how many people are interested in. It's basically a web-based application. It's not on the public, you know, internet. It's just for law enforcement, but it's a web-based. So all you need is a browser to access it. It uses standard database, allows to have multiple jurisdictions, and we have security based on jurisdiction. So you can have different jurisdiction using it at the same time. All the lists can be customized. Of course, we provide audit log. We have reporting. Support major browsers. There's no client install, and we kind of designed it to be easy to use, easy to install, so that way we can share it with, it's currently at 6 other police departments in other states, and we actually traveled there, we installed it, we gave them some training, and they're using it, so we want something that they can, easily manage themselves, and easy to use, not a lot of support involved. It's just a diagram. It's basically kind of shows that it's web-based, and there's a web server, database, and we can generate reports.
That's it.
That's our contact information. If you have any questions, and there's a lot of data, a lot of fields. Usually, we give this presentation in an interactive. We actually show the application and we show you the data, but we kind of opted for PowerPoint style. But be glad to answer any questions you have.
Any questions, folks? Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you so much for sharing this. And I'm impressed. It seems to be a pretty sophisticated system. You mentioned the Victims Rights Law Center. So, of course, my brain jumped to privacy. And just was wondering, as part of the development of this program, some of the privacy concerns that may have come up, and if there were folks that have an eye for that sort of thing that were part of those conversations. And I'm thinking specifically around the information that's collected about the nonprofit community-based advocacy programs and who's electing to add that information to the tracking, if it's the victim gives permission for that. And just if you can help me understand that.
Each jurisdiction does it differently.
Okay.
Mobile, Alabama is probably the agency that uses it the most. Mm-hmm. And they actually have a rape crisis center that is a nonprofit organization. So what they have chosen to do is the advocates only have access to that. I think it's just the advocate screen.
Just the advocate.
And not into anything else. And the investigators do not. Nobody but the nonprofit has access to that.
Okay. That's helpful. I wasn't sure who.
Each one of those tabs, each page, right. A case page, victim, suspect, you can lock people in and out of those as you choose.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet. So, first, a couple comments, but also a couple questions. So comments deal with outstanding work. And Multnomah County's District Attorney's Office couldn't be more pleased than a partnership that we've established with the Portland Police Bureau and others. It's been immensely beneficial to our community. And now it's translating to our state. And today's presentation makes me know that it's translating to our country. Right. So that partnership, that good work, has also manifested itself in some real tangible things, such as being honored by the Summit of Cities right? The BJA, Saki, some of the cities recognizing Oregon's work and having in October their conference here in Oregon. So once again, thank you, Susan. We haven't met. It's a pleasure to meet you today.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you for your hard work. Couple questions, and this really, maybe it jumps off the last question, and it deals with certainly an awareness and a sensitivity surrounding privacy. I'm going to contrast that with an awareness and sensitivity to statutory constitutional obligations as it relates to discovery, mm-hmm. and making sure that both are thought of and addressed, right? So as I listened, most of what I believe I heard, and this is really the kind of foundational of the question, is someone is taking information and taking it from a discoverable document like a police report and essentially doing data entry, I'm going to call
Correct.
It.
Mm-hmm.
My question really moves into then, is there any what I would call original or information that is taken by an investigator that may not find itself in an investigative report, and the SAM system is the only home for it, right? Which then moves into a translation of, are we working well together, a prosecutor's office, a law enforcement agency, and making sure that we're accommodating our constitutional mm-hmm. or statutory discovery obligations?
So the only original information would be the advocate notes, which we developed mm-hmm. to be printable, and we have provided those to DAs before.
Great.
The other thing that might be slightly new would be if you selected a fetish.
Okay.
I mean, the perpetrator's actions should determine that fetish, but for someone to actually put a label on it would be the only other new information.
Okay. Second question, if I may. So I listened a couple of different terms, enough data in. It made me think, okay, well, you know, where are we in the continuum of having enough data to start to draw pictures, mm-hmm. Right?
Sure.
From what we're seeing. And within that question, is a report contemplated? Is a more formal report being contemplated? I literally don't know the answers.
So we didn't show the reporting screen here, but SAMS already has several reports built into it. And mm-hmm. part of the SAMS 2.0 project is to build in more business analytics. And so that'll be on the horizon in the next 16 months or so.
Great.
We've already put information out to our partners to get information back on what they want to see for reporting.
Okay.
Yeah, so we've been using SAMS for a little bit over a year and a half now. So, yeah, we did collect, you know, quite a bit of information. Our advocates have updated the cases and, you know, all from the police reports. And so right now, you know, we have the ability to, like, ad hoc reporting. If Susan wants a specific report, yeah, usually I create it. If you want, you know, things that we don't have already kind of written, but part of SAMS 2 would be creating, you know, tools for the users themselves to do ad hoc querying, to do their own personal dashboards, for example, do analytics by themselves. But that's under development. In the meantime, yeah, we can, you know, if you have like specific reports or specific query, yeah, we can get the data out of the database. We just haven't built the tools to give to the users themselves to do more advanced querying and analysis.
Great. Well, thank you. And once again, Susan, thank you for your passion and dedication. It's also good to meet a partner of yours that shares your passion and dedication. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Anybody else?
I do. I have a few questions, and I also want to commend you for the great work you've done. Out of respect for your time and everybody else's time, I just have bulleted questions, and then I'm probably going to want to call afterwards. But the first is, how long does it typically take to get an agency up and running?
There's an IGA that they need to sign, so that is the longest period. Which we don't have control over, but once we get a signed IGA, we will do installation within 2 weeks, usually, and it takes us about 3 days on site.
And then it's a obviously a fabulously powerful tool, and it's a great repository of information. And would it be possible for agencies, say in Oregon, if it's more widely deployed in Oregon? I can imagine benefits of having Multnomah, Clackamas, Marion County all being able to access each other's information to look for particular profiles, for example. Could that be done by sharing, by permissions? Basically, if we allow another agency, if we import this, can we allow another agency to populate our database and vice versa?
I think sure. I think the only issue is access to the data from a network standpoint. Right now, for example, the Portland Police, I think Multnomah DA, they have access, but if we're talking to somebody in Lane County. Currently, there is no network access. I think it would be best if it was like stored, at the state level. I think ultimately that's probably where it should be. Whereas, as a state level, kind of holds all the information, and I think most police departments probably have access to OSP. And we did discuss it probably 6-7 months ago. Would it make sense for OSP to host a bigger SAMS that's multiple jurisdiction can use? Can I answer your question? I think it is possible. We just have to kind of set up, the network connectivity, and that can take a while. If you're, doing it kind of statewide, then do they access, Portland network, or it's better to have kind of a state, an OSP, server that's accessed by all the jurisdictions for the information, either in the detail level or summary level, whichever makes sense.
Last question. Actually, I have many others, but I won't use group time for that. But what is the projected deployment date for Phase 2? I won't hold you to it. But
yeah. Well, Phase 2 has like five different components. And the first one is the barcode scanning. And it's basically an app you deploy on your iPhone or Android. That one, we'll start our own testing in Portland at the end of this month. And we're projecting, we'll make it available to our agencies probably in the June 2018, June-July timeframe for the mobile app. And then we have incremental updates. So all the agencies that are already using SAMS, typically every quarter we'll give them updates, either bug fixes, new reports, or some of these major components that we're building. And it's probably going to go on for the next 2 years to get all the features and that are included in our 800K Saki grant. And I think we're going to be probably applying for a new grant.
Yeah, we'll apply for a new grant this next quarter because the Department of Justice has contacted us and wants us to do an automatic upload into VICAP from SAMS. So that'll be SAMS 3, maybe.
Yeah. And even within Portland Police, we kind of have in our homicide detectives are interested in SAMS because this is not just a sex crimes only. A lot of the components apply to homicides as well. So it's really kind of growing. Kind of started as a custom application just for the sex crime units and. Turned out to be, deployed in other states, in other departments. We can talking to, other states that are looking for a statewide solution as well. We have given many presentations to a number of states, across the country. Either they're interested in SAMS or they want to learn from what we have developed so they can develop a solution for their state. And I'm more than happy to share with you, more information. We can, provide you with the, live demo, that shows you the data and how do you interact with the application. We're happy to do that. We'll set up a web conference and.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I have a question. This is absolutely amazing. So what was the catalyst to make it start?
Well, I had this spreadsheet that went from 16, I think in the end, at the end of my spreadsheet, just to track the grant, but just to track the SafeKit data that Portland Police had, it turned out to be like 68 columns. And it was just unmanageable. And you can't see all the data at once. You can't see, it just makes errors. And I spent 17 years in our records department. So I went to Commander Burke and I says, help me, we got to do something. Because this, you know, garbage in, garbage out. And so when we created SAMS, I used all the knowledge I had from being a trainer in records to reduce the number of user errors, hopefully, that goes into SAMS, and to make it easier to track, basically.
Well, nicely done.
Yeah, it's very cool.
Amazing, amazing. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anybody else?
Anything else?
All right.
And thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Alrighty. So next up is the SafeKit Post-Conviction Protocol and Practice. Tara and Amity?
Yes.
All right.
Hello.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us. All right. Okay. All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Amity Gert from the Multnomah County DA's office, and this is Tara Gardner, also from the Multnomah County DA's office. It feels a little strange to sit and present, but it's also kind of nice. So I'm going to start with this presentation because early on when our office started this grant project, I was the deputy DA that was assigned to the project, and Tara will pick it up about halfway through because she is currently assigned to the project. So I wanted to just, I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I know you guys are aware of how this project started, but just sort of go over a little bit of background information on it. Our office got the DANI grant in 2015 from the District Attorney's Office in New York County, and we got the almost max award of just under $2 million for our office to test the untested sexual assault forensic evidence kits from Multnomah County, Wayne County, Marion County. And we did that by application. We were the lead applicant on that project. And then as sort of a response to getting the grant award, we created a unit within our office that consisted of myself, a forensic consultant, Susan Horman, who used to be at OSP, and then a victim advocate. And so that's still how this group is made up. And so about late 2015 is when that unit formed, and that was about at the same time that we were finishing up our lab contract with Sorensen Forensics in Salt Lake City, Utah, because they were the private lab that got the contract award. And so we were sort of finishing up the details of how that would look, and it was April 1st, 2016 that we got the funding, you know, finally through and approved, and we could start sending kits. And so around that same time period, we identified the need to have some infrastructure in place to make sure that we had a kind of a plan for how we were going to attack this project, because it was a little bit unusual in that our county was going to be responsible for making sure that these other two counties were sending their kits under our grant project, and then making sure that they got the information back when the information was tested, that the results were sent back to them. And so we developed a sort of front-end policy that was the grant handbook that was disseminated to all the law enforcement agencies in the two other counties to just give them sort of the nuts and bolts and start to finish what we thought this project would look like. And then we focused our attention at the same time to creating two policies that were more of the sort of back end, or rather when we got the kit results back, how were we going to approach the work. And those two were the victim notification policy and then also our post-conviction policy. And that's what this presentation will focus on, the post-conviction policy. It became clear early on that, you know, these kits that we were going to be sending in were, that there were going to be a number of them that actually belonged to cases that we had prosecuted in some fashion, whether as an adult, you know, criminal conviction level or juvenile adjudications. So with that in mind, we wanted to have some policy in place and sort of some points to make sure that we were approaching the same for all these cases that came back after the testing was complete. So the post-conviction policy, I believe, was provided in materials ahead of time. We finished that in June 2016. And as other jurisdictions across the country were also getting started on this grant project, whether it was the Danny grant or the Sackey grant or both, there were some conventions and conferences and that sort of thing where people were information sharing and talking about kind of what they had done to get going on this project. And I went to the first couple of those, and it became clear, at least from the folks that I talked to in the cities and jurisdictions that were represented at these meetings, that this post-conviction policy appeared to be kind of the first of its kind. And so we got some requests to, you know, share what we have so that we were able to provide, you know, other counties and cities across the country with this is kind of what we have put into place to attack this project from the perspective of cases where the, you know, the case has already been prosecuted and you're testing this kit now. We also shared it with Marion County and the Lane County District Attorney's Office as they were involved early on in this project. So with our post-conviction policy, we are, as we get results back from the private crime lab, which is Sorenson Forensics, we basically get like a, we were getting a list of uploaded cases every month, the kits that they had tested from that month. And the batches were, you know, somewhere between maybe 50 to 130 cases that they had finished testing on that month. And they come with sort of a list of, you know, here's the Sorenson forensic case number, here's the agency case number, and here was the result category, which I'll get into in just a little bit. But with that information, what we would do every month when we get this upload is start cross-checking the agency case number in our system to figure out, did we prosecute this case already? And for the counties that, you know, were not within Multnomah, or the law enforcement agencies, rather, not within Multnomah County, we could tell from the upload usually and what sort of that case file looked like, whether or not it was likely to have been adjudicated or prosecuted. And just simply put, most cases that went to prosecution, you could tell right off the bat because there were more reports and it just looked like it was a more complete investigation. So we would start, you know, highlighting and keeping a list from the batch that was uploaded that month of cases that appeared to have been prosecuted. And we did that for, you know, not only adult prosecutions, but cases where we could tell from the case information that the suspect would have been a juvenile. So then we're looking to our, you know, what records would be available to know that the case was prosecuted as on the juvenile level. So we'd get that information together on a month-to-month basis. And for the case results that were of the categories of being negative for male DNA or ineligible for CODIS for male DNA, so that's two of the three possible case result categories from Sorenson Forensics, we would start the process of reviewing the file and determining what needed to be done on a case review basis. For the ones that generated a result that was CODIS comparable, meaning it was going to be reviewed by OSP for possible CODIS upload, we would then, we kind of table that case and wait for the CODIS result to come back. So the case review process would really start in our office if it was coming from Sorenson and it was a negative for male DNA or ineligible for CODIS. That would kind of start the process as of us looking at the file information that we still have. So we would be ordering up our old files. We would be collecting the police reports that we had already from that case, seeing if there were any, you know, notes from our own system that would maybe explain kind of what the case was about. And most of these cases, we've been able to dig up the old files from, and so we would order those and just, you know, start going through them one by one. And I just wanted to point this out at the bottom because it is true for every single case that we're sending in under this project, whether we get a CODIS comparable result, CODIS ineligible, or negative for male DNA. Once we get that result back, that lab report, the forensic lab report, whether it's just from Sorenson or whether it's a combination of Sorenson and OSP, will go to the last known defense attorney. All right. So, I'm going to forward to my notes here real quick. Yeah. So, Tara is going to take it from here and talking about what these reviews actually look like when we're looking at these cases.
So as Amity said, we order a case file. We've been able to have a case file for almost all of these. And to date, we've gone through about approximately 80 cases. And so these are cases that fall within all three categories of the results we received back from Sorensen and OSP. So those are cases where the kit was negative for male DNA, where the profile or the DNA discovered was ineligible for CODIS, or where it was entered into CODIS and we're waiting for a match. And with those cases, we do a comprehensive case review. And we review all the police reports. We review any notes from the prior DDA. If the DDA still works in the office, sometimes we'll just go talk to them, walk down the hall, and kind of compare notes. And we're looking at a variety of different elements because we wanted to make sure that our review of these cases was very comprehensive and that it was very detailed and that we were applying that level of scrutiny consistently with each case. And so we make sure that we look at, you know, what were the facts of the case, what specific facts are going to support the conviction, what was the conviction for, and how did that conviction come about? Was this a plea or was it a trial? The sentence then that was received, whether that, again, part of plea negotiations or the sentence following trial. We look at, sometimes there was evidence that was tested. We've run across several cases where there had been testing, whether that was back in the 90s and it was far more simplistic than the forensic testing that's done today. We examine that. We also examine, was there any evidence that was collected that hasn't been tested and maybe we should test it? And here specifically, we're usually looking at clothing, sometimes other fabrics such as bed sheets. We also, a key point that I want to highlight is, does the discovery clearly indicate that there was a kit that was collected? And usually we find this in a property receipt, in medical records, or sometimes it's just in the narrative of the police report. But we want to evaluate that to see if all the parties, defense counsel, had noticed that this evidence was out there. Then we look at, of course, what the results were from the safe kit that was tested, and then we just kind of boil it down to what is the significance of the forensic results we have from the safe kit being tested, and what bearing does that have on the case and the conviction. So then we kind of gather all of our facts and details and reach an opinion or conclusion regarding the significance, because what we're looking at is to make sure that, one, of course, we look at, with the CODIS match, was that the defendant that received the conviction? To date, they have all been a match, and so there haven't been any discrepancies that have turned up with cases that have been moved on to OSP and then entered into CODIS. For the cases that from Sorensen were ineligible or for negative, we look at why that might be. Sometimes the case itself provides an explanation. Just for example, sometimes there's cases where the safe kit that was collected was separated in time from the incident date, but out of an abundance of caution, the kit was still done, and we've seen these in cases involving children victims. We've also seen certain facts where a condom was used, and that might explain why the kit was negative or ineligible. The helpful part of this process is that this is also reviewed by the forensic consultant, Susan Horman, that works in our office. And so she's applying her expertise that she has with working for OSP for decades and looking at the evidence as well. And she's doing that review separate from our review. And so that's a second set of eyes that is evaluating the same information, but with the perspective of a forensic scientist. Then the third set of eyes that looks at this is the chief deputy. And the chief deputy, Don Reese, will then review this information as well. And then if he agrees with the conclusion, to date, every single one of these has resulted in no further testing or any other steps, but we make sure that all of the reports are sent to the last known defense attorney or defense firm so that all of that discovery is being provided, along with a letter explaining what this is for, the case and part of the project. We also have a policy in place where maybe further action would be taken, and this would then be where the case is forwarded to the Conviction Integrity Unit that's in our office. And we haven't had any of these cases go forward to this process yet because, as I've said, we've had approximately 80 cases we reviewed. Those have all been a CODIS match to the defendant, or there is a pretty clear reason looking at the totality of the evidence as to why the evidence from the kit or the lack of DNA evidence doesn't have a bearing on the conviction when looking at the totality of the other evidence. But we do have this process in place because we want to make sure that if the situation does arise where we do believe it needs to be furthered on, that it is going to be forwarded to this committee, and they're going to determine whether further investigation is warranted, giving the result. And then just to, again, summarize, no matter what the decision, we're making sure that all of the reports are being sent to defense counsel for that individual, the firm. In some cases, defense counsel has passed away, and there's nobody that was left to take up that individual's practice. And so we ensure that we track down the individual themselves, the defendant, and send them the reports as well. To date, we haven't received any inquiries back as to why we're sending this information or questioning what we've sent in. So it's been a pretty consistent kind of path for all of these cases to date. So I think that wraps it up. Lots of questions.
Yeah, questions? You good?
No question, but if I may, another comment.
Are you going to applaud your team?
Maybe I'll let you applaud them if appropriate. But yes, I am, for a moment. Thank you for your hard work. Amity, I know you've been from the ground up forming this policy and others, so thank you for your passion and dedication. And Tara, a quick veteran after only a quick few months of catching up and taking over the project, and thank you. Thanks for allowing me to do that, Chair.
You're welcome.
I think I'm the only lawyer on this committee who hasn't spoken yet today.
Keep going.
That is unusual.
I know it is unusual.
Are you ready to speak?
I'm not.
Okay. All righty. Hey, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Very
thank
helpful.
You. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. And next up, under wrongful convictions, DNA testing and other issues, Steve Wax and Brittany Pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for being here. This is going to be a fascinating topic.
Well, Rep. Lusso, Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us. I'm Steve Wax, Legal Director of the Oregon Innocence Project. Brittany Pleasure is Staff Attorney. I thought it might make sense to start with why are we here? What is our interest, and hopefully what information do we have that could be useful to you? The Oregon Innocence Project was established in 2014, and our role is to receive inquiries from people who have been convicted and say, I'm innocent. Not people who say the system failed me. Because my lawyer did this or the prosecutor did that, but I didn't commit the crime or no crime was committed. In that regard, our role is quite different from the role of defense counsel. We exist as a project in an effort to attempt to do justice, to further the search for truth. And for me personally, that was a very interesting transition from my time as a defense attorney, because I get to say no, which as a public defender, you can't. Person walks in, court says represent this person, and you do what you need to do and what the system should have lawyers doing. But in this role, we do get to say no. We've had more than 400 requests for assistance since we opened our doors. And we have screened at this point close to 300 of those requests, and we have said to the overwhelming majority of those people, we cannot help you. We have only taken on 5 clients. All the rest of the cases we've screened, with the exception of 10 or so that are still in progress, we have said sorry. In terms of the number and types of cases that we are asked to look at, I was quite surprised that the majority are from people who have been convicted of sex offenses. And the majority of those people were convicted of sex offenses against children. More than 250 cases have been screened so far involving primarily child sex offenses. And from that review, I think that we have had a very interesting and perhaps unique opportunity to take a look at the manner in which sex offense cases, particularly child sex offense cases, are investigated, prosecuted, and defended in this state. Part of our work in those cases and part of our work in the other cases that we have looked at involves DNA. And as part of that work, I think that we have gained some knowledge, I don't want to use the word expertise yet, but some knowledge about the way in which DNA is used, can be used, and can be very helpful in investigating and prosecuting and defending cases. But DNA has also told us something else about our system. It has helped, I believe, throughout the nation and now here in Oregon in understanding how wrongful convictions, that is, the conviction of innocent people, can happen. There is a national registry of exonerees that has been put together over the last 20 or so years, and right now there are 2,152 people on that registry. Of those, fewer than a quarter involve DNA exonerations. But what DNA has enabled us, those of us who study the criminal justice system, to get a better understanding of is other causes of wrongful convictions. And those include false confessions, bad lawyering, withholding of evidence by police or prosecutors, the frailty and failings in eyewitness identification, problems with science, junk science, and pseudoscience, and false allegations. And I'll get back to false allegations a little bit later in the talk, because the unfortunate reality that we have to deal with, and that I think is important for everyone on this task force to recognize, is that the reason why there have been exonerations in 250-some-odd sex offense cases is that there have been a substantial number in which there have been false allegations. And in some of those in which the false allegation has been supported by recantations that courts, prosecutors, police, and defense counsel have taken a look at. So, having set the stage with that, I will turn the microphone over to Brittany to talk about the testing issue, and I'll then get back to investigation issues beyond testing, and then hand it back to Brittany for another word on that.
So I first want to commend everyone for all of this backlog testing. It's fantastic. The prevention of future backlog is just really, really commendable. But of course, we're here to talk about wrongful convictions and the reality. And however small the risk, it's worth creating a policy for even one man or one woman who's wrongfully imprisoned. And I really commend Multnomah County DA's office for also understanding that that risk is worth creating a policy. The risk really is, when we're doing this backlog testing, especially the kits that are ending up in Sorenson, my understanding is the way they're being handled at the OSP lab is somewhat different, but the kits being sent to Sorenson are largely being sent the kits on their own, and I'm talking particularly about the cases that have already been prosecuted in some way or the other. But once those kits get sent to Sorenson, they're not being sent with other evidence related to the case. And so the risk is in counties that are less resourced than Multnomah County, that there could be a wrongful conviction that we're not catching. And so Multnomah County has, I understand from their post-conviction policy, a database in place so that they can connect the conviction with the testing result. Fantastic. We're here to make sure that no other county goes without this sort of database so that we can quickly connect the test with the prior prosecution. And so this is an issue that I've heard about out of Detroit, a woman who was handling potential wrongful convictions in Detroit for the 10,000 some odd backlogged kits in all of Michigan. This was a huge problem for her, just even connecting the dots between the conviction and the testing. And so, again, however small the risk, let's just have a policy in place just in case it could happen. And I think the Multnomah County DA's policy is a great place to start as a statewide policy. Of course, with an eye toward wrongful convictions, we have some recommendations for improvements, additions, and so I'll go through those. First, in going through the case review factors, while I understand that whether or not a case outcome is determined by trial or plea, I just want to make sure it's not a deciding factor. Of course, there are a host of considerations that defendants take into account when they're making plea decisions, and oftentimes those aren't communicated to the prosecuting attorney. And additionally, of the 353 DNA exonerations, 39 of those, or 11%, originally were adjudicated through a plea deal. So I just want to make sure that's not a determining factor. There's another category to be looked at. I'm calling it the other probative evidence category, and I just want to make sure there can be some language added in there to include evidence that may also be exculpatory. So looking at evidence not just that could support a conviction, but also could potentially support a wrongful conviction. Let's see. On to the sections regarding disseminating information to the last known attorney and defendant. This is fantastic. The reality is that a defendant may not know what to do with this information. Another unfortunate reality is that an attorney may not take responsibility for the results of the additional the results and additional review, and OPDS is not likely to assign counsel to handle the review of these cases. This has certainly been the experience in our office when what we call an inquirer, a person writing to our office, comes to us with information that's new after the conviction. Oftentimes we'll reach out to the last known defense attorney who received the information, and he or she will tell us, I'm off the case, I'm not assigned anymore, I have nothing to do with it. And so this information sits and waits for a long time, which is really not helpful for a meaningful review of the information. There really needs to be some entity in place who's responsible for review for the defendant. We're certainly prepared to do that. Of course, that would take additional funding. We're a small nonprofit. But if the task force is wanting to address this issue of helping out defense with review of these cases, we will make ourselves available, and we just hope that it's included in your review and if any report is created. In addition to the information given to defense counsel, we hope that more than just the lab report is being provided. We hope that additional information like electropharograms or the charts and graphs that are created that go along with the report and any bench notes or anything, any additional data that's being received by a district attorney's office, we would hope though that information is also being given to the last known attorney, defendant, whatever entity is going to be assisting in reviewing these cases to do a real meaningful review of DNA. Of course, we know that we need more than just the final report. If an attorney decided to hire some sort of expert to help review the data, they're going to need that extra information to determine whether or not the analyst agrees with the analysis done in the case. Because, of course, most DNA testing is really objective, but when it comes to analysis, there are subjective components. And so experts may differ. And so to do that, we need more information. So I'll let Steve discuss the timing of disclosure.
Yeah, so the third issue that we want to put before you, and it must include a question, Rod, if we can put it, is when the disclosure is being made to either the last known counsel or the defendant. It's terrific to hear that part of the policy is to make that disclosure. As we read the written policy, it appeared as though that disclosure may not be made until after your office has concluded its review. And if that's the case, we would urge you to revisit that, and we would urge the task force, if you are going to take up the suggestion to create or direct someone to create a protocol for the state, for the other district attorneys and jurisdictions in the state, to include a provision that the disclosure should be made to whichever entity this is, or counsel or the defendant, when the report comes back to the district attorney's office. You know, our concern is that after an agency, a district attorney's office, has gone through the type of extensive review which Rod's office has outlined, I think it's far more difficult to get a full, fairer, more complete review of a defendant, defense attorney who comes in and says, now, wait a minute, you might want to consider this or you might want to consider that. I think that if this process is based on, which it is, a scientific piece of evidence, the most objective type, although not entirely objective, type of evidence available in the criminal justice system, DNA, then make the disclosure early, let a defendant defense attorney take a look at it. I think that what you will find is what the district attorney's office has just reported. In the overwhelming majority, if not all of the cases, the result is not going to lead a person to say, gosh golly, you know, look here, look there, because the result is going to be confirming whatever, you know, has already occurred. But in the event that there is a wrongful conviction, get that information out sooner rather than later. One other comment about the suggestion that there needs to be some entity, some disclosure made to people other than a last known defense attorney or a defendant. It has been very disturbing to me to see the difference in this regard between the state and federal defense systems. In the federal system, once a lawyer, basically, you're the lawyer. 10 years later, if you're still alive and still in practice and something comes up, the federal system is going to reactivate the assignment. What we've found in the state system, and this came most recently when we received notice from a district attorney's office that there had been a recantation in a child sex case. We got notice of that a year and a half after notice had been given to the last known defense attorney, who did absolutely nothing. And when I called that person and spoke with that person, the person said, you know, my case is closed. I am not this person's lawyer anymore. We've had that response on a number of occasions. Hence the suggestion, it's just not enough. You need to have some other group in some form taking a look at this. All right. So, investigations, moving away from this DNA-specific issue. As we read the statute, we saw that the charge to this task force is not only to look at the rape kit testing issue, but to look at investigation in sex offenses more generally. And if indeed you're going to be taking up that portion of the legislative charge, we encourage you to take a look at the unique nature of sex offense case investigation. The unique nature is recognized in the state right now by the manner in which the investigations are handled. There are the child abuse multidisciplinary task forces. We have the fund that the Department of Justice has to distribute to the various counties to put together these multidisciplinary groups. We have the sex offender guidelines, and Brittany will be talking about these some more. But that's unique in terms of the recognition by the state, by the people engaged in law enforcement and prosecution in the state, that there's something different about sex offenses. One of the differences, I think, is the fact that they are, in many instances, the only or virtually only type of crime where there is no what we lawyers call corpus delicti. There's no physical evidence that a crime has been committed. And as we have reviewed the 250 or so cases that we have reviewed, and see patterns of allegation, the circumstances under which the allegations are made so often involve custody disputes, boyfriend-girlfriend disputes, the defenses that are put up, the circumstances under which the allegations come forward have some patterns in them, patterns which have led us to create these different ways of initiating the investigations. In conducting the investigations, part of what we have to keep in mind is that there are these false allegations. They exist. It's a reality of life that may be uncomfortable for all of us, but it's there. If there is a false allegation, it doesn't mean there isn't a problem. Part of the multidisciplinary task force approach here is to get people who are trained in dealing with victims into the process, to get people who are trained in trying to figure out what's going on in families into the process. And we need to be sure that we're trying to determine as effectively as we can whether the problem that's presented when a child in particular goes into a CARES unit or a family, you know, protective unit, or to a DHS person, a child protective person, whether the problem is that this child has been abused sexually or whether there is another problem that needs to be addressed. So in trying to figure out how best to investigate these cases, I think part of what we need to keep in mind is that we need to be sure that we are identifying the correct problem, and then that we are able as a society to provide the proper resources to the child, to the family. There are some real-world benefits to ensuring that the investigations are handled properly. Because if the investigations are done as effectively as they can be, and the allegation is, as the overwhelming majority of them are, grounded in reality, investigated properly, dispositions, pleas, are likely to be more readily forthcoming. There'll be less cost, less harm to the child, because there will likely be fewer trials. If the investigations are handled as effectively as they can, with interviews by the best trained people, the information that's obtained is likely to be more reliable. And if it is more reliable, again, the manner in which the cases are handled in the criminal justice system or in the juvenile system likely to lead to quicker, more efficient, and results that will stick better because there will be fewer issues that can be raised down the road in post-conviction processes. Part of what we have seen in the investigations is that leads are missed. Questions that need to be asked are not asked. Sometimes it's, as has already been noted, evidence isn't gathered, whether it's bed sheets, chair covers. If people are better trained and involved in the investigation with better training, the investigation will be better. And whether that is training for law enforcement officers, people working in CARES units, people working in hospitals, there is a lot that we are seeing that reality, as the legal director of OIP, I wish that that evidence had been gathered properly. It would make it far more difficult for some people to say, I'm innocent, if they're confronted with clear, solid, properly obtained evidence. That is far more difficult to challenge. And I think that that is in everyone's interest, and as a matter of public policy, it's what we should all be striving for. So I'm going to turn it back to Brittany to get into some specific suggestions that we have for improving the manner in which the sex abuse cases, particularly child sex abuse cases, are investigated, who does the investigation, and under what sort of guidelines.
Sure. So as Steve mentioned, having reviewed hundreds of these cases at this point from all over the state, we're pretty uniquely situated to talk about the subject. We've also spoken with attorneys who have defended the cases, attorneys who have prosecuted the cases, and expert psychologists who have helped to analyze the interviews in these cases. And we've come to understand that Oregon can improve. So we just want to ensure we're getting things right and we're getting the most and the most accurate information out of these cases. So the first way that we can improve as a state is by getting children to these interview centers right away, getting them there to be interviewed by the person who is trained and who is up to date in training. What we've seen and what we've heard from those who handle these cases at the trial level is that, This is a problem coming from a few different directions. One is resource allocation. Of course, certain centers just don't have the same resources as others. But I think the goal should be for up-to-date, trained interviewers to be employed at each of these centers. And in some cases, we know that they're just on call. And so there gets to be a backlog of weeks at a time. And any expert psychologist who studies child memory will tell you the importance of the first interview happening right away, happening at a center that is more neutral than a home or a law enforcement office, and is actually being recorded so that it can be reviewed properly. And so right now, there are some counties that are doing it well and some where it's just not happening the way that it should happen and we're not getting the best information from the child in these cases. The other way we can improve is field interviews. Field interviews are generally conducted by law enforcement and these should be as short as possible only to determine whether to conduct further investigation in the case. I know that our guidelines, our Oregon interview guidelines as they're laid out right now, allow for some discretion for law enforcement to do a complete interview. Our prior guidelines, the second edition, didn't allow for as much discretion, and we really recommend that we go back to that. It's really problematic for someone who's not trained in interviewing children to be conducting these interviews, to be conducting them at homes, and to oftentimes not be recording those interviews. So, of course, resources are a problem. We don't have enough resources to be sending every child to these centers right away, but I think that should be a goal of this task force. And continual training for these interviewers. Where there are interviewers, let's get them trained and have the training be ongoing. There are many studies. One that I can think of now is by Michael Lamb, who is just the guy on this issue of child memory, that says he watched trained interviewers over a period of time, and you could see the interviewer slipping. And so interviewers need to be up on their training, constantly repeating the same training if it need be, because there are so many things that we need to be aware of when we're conducting these interviews. In addition to ensuring that the right person is conducting the interview and it's getting conducted as soon as we possibly can, there's more information, as Steve mentioned, that we can be gathering from these forensic interviews. This information could corroborate or bring context to certain allegations. So first, we want to be asking children about prior conversations regarding the alleged incident. The NICHD guidelines, the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, it's in this book. It's very handy, this book. I recommend everyone gets it. It's called Tell Me What Happened. This is an agency that employs some of the top scientists, psychologists in the nation on child interviewing. And in their guidelines, there's a whole section about questioning the child about prior conversations about the alleged incident. And why this is important is because it can allow you to develop additional witnesses. So if the child is much more comfortable around someone they've known their whole lives, and they've already talked about the event to that person, we may be able to get more information than we would from a child interviewer who the child just frankly may not be comfortable around. And so getting this information about prior conversations can be so important to gathering more investigative information. So a second way we can get more information is that our current guidelines no longer have a specific focus on asking about the special circumstances that could have come into play. So a family issue, say there's custody problems, divorce, anything that's going on at home, say there's something going on at school. While we still train people to ask about these questions, there used to be a great focus in our guidelines, and I really recommend that we bring that back because all of that information is relevant to the allegation. So these improvements I'm suggesting should be reflected in interview guidelines and in training of people who are conducting these interviews. The current version of Oregon's interview guidelines, which were put out in 2012, are in some ways commendable in their improvements. They now focus on invitational questions. These are open questions that use prompts based on the child's own words. So you said X, use child's words there. Tell me more. So that's sort of an open question, but you're using the child's words to get to a certain point of the interview that you want to get to. These types of questions have found to be the most effective way to get information from a child's recall memory, and that's the information we're looking for. And so Oregon's current version does a great job of incorporating these invitational questions. As Oregon Innocence Project, we always focus on following the latest and greatest of scientific practices. And so there are ways in which Oregon's guidelines do that, and there are areas where they're not necessarily up to date. So one of those areas, as I've already discussed, is these instructions on field interviews and allowing field interviewers who are either not trained or not trained well to conduct entire interviews. So the history of Oregon's guidelines is relevant. So Oregon created its guidelines in 1998. They were created by Dr. Wendy Borg. She still is working on this issue in the state, along with many other people, but she spearheaded authoring that. And they were created because there just weren't guidelines elsewhere on how to interview children. How do we conduct these? But in 2000, like I mentioned, the NICHD put out its guidelines, and these are now the gold standard. So really, we just advocate that we adopt these guidelines. They're coming from this neutral body of the top psychologists in the country. We should be using that resource that's already there for us. We no longer need our guidelines that are sort of taken piecemeal from other places, and because of that piecemeal approach, we're not necessarily getting everything we need. So in speaking with experts in the areas of child psychology, Drs. Riesberg and Borg, we've come up with some places in which our guidelines fall in line with the current science, like I said, and places where they either fall short or improperly state the science. So our guidelines include special instruction for interviewing young children, asking more direct questions. However, the science tells us that if we stick to these invitational questions, like we ask any child of any age, we're really still going to get the best information from a child of any age. And in fact, the risk of getting false answers from direct questioning is highest in these children who are of a much younger age. They're more suggestible. And so the risk of asking direct questions really outweighs the benefit of getting, you know, maybe one or two more sentences of information. There's also a section in our guidelines on child development, which is largely irrelevant to allegations of abuse. While it can be helpful to know what a child may be doing at certain ages, it's problematic in the guidelines because it suggests that these cues are actually relevant to abuse when oftentimes, you know, of course, the children from different social backgrounds with different developmental issues, there can be tons of different reasons why a child may not fit the description in the guidelines. And then there's an area in the guidelines in the section on child suggestibility where it says that suggestibility is less likely to be a risk when the memory includes strong, salient details. Well, the science tells us that false memories can also be rich. And sometimes true memories can have less detail because false memories go through this embellishment process over time. And so it's really, we can't tell based on the amount of detail whether a memory is true or false. So it's just not good to have that in there. And lastly, I'll just state one more place where I think our guidelines could improve or is not following the science. There's a section on source monitoring where it says it's important to note that it is unlikely that a child will be knowledgeable in detailed sexual activities unless she is subject to extended periods of directly witnessing the activity, told in great detail on multiple occasions about how the activity occurs or participates directly in the activity. Children are not likely to dream about sexual abuse events or make detailed reports based on what others have told them. Having spoken with multiple experts, this is just not true. There are other reasons why a child may have this sort of memory. It's not true that a child won't dream about it unless they've experienced it or have had really detailed conversations about it. There are just other sources for this information. These are just some examples of where we could be improving. I really hope we've been able to set the table for you on places we think, where we think Oregon could be doing better. You know, these issues with current practices and child sexual abuse investigations, we really think is worthy of a more in-depth analysis. And so we would love to chat about it more anytime, about it with any of you individually. Drs. Riesberg and Borg have made themselves available also if anybody is interested in learning about the psychology behind all of this. And we really thank you for your time.
Thank you. And that's a very generous offer. I appreciate that very much. Any questions from the dais?
I do. No, you go first.
I get to go first.
It's your turn.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Thank you for being here. I do appreciate part of what you said, and I want to just call some attention to it, is that in this world of mandatory minimum sentencing and prosecutorial power, is that innocent people do plead guilty. And I'm ashamed to tell you, I help them do it all the time. Because sometimes the conversation has to be, how risk averse are you? And that's one of the great sadnesses of my life, quite frankly. So I just appreciate you saying that, pointing that out to us.
Well, thank you, Deanna. You know, it is very troubling to see the length of sentences that are handed down in these cases, 500 months, 600 months, 800 months. You know, we had about 2 weeks ago, no, a little earlier before the students went on break, talked with two different people in the same day. One took a plea and was given a five-year sentence. He says, I didn't do it. We're looking into his case. The other went to trial, 50-year sentence. It's a death sentence. I mean, the fellow is going to die in prison. He's 40, you know, something. And I think that as a task force looking into the manner in which cases are investigated, it's important to keep in mind the context that the sentences handed down in a fair percentage of these sex cases involving children is greater than in almost any other type of crime. And sex offenders, at least as we've seen it, Rod, you may have more knowledge about this, very difficult to get out on parole. If you get a 30, 40, 50-year sentence, we've had a number of people who have contacted us and they meet the parole board and they're just sent back. So I think that context is important to keep in mind in trying to figure out what do we owe the system, what do we owe the people we are proposing to put in prison for incredibly long sentences? How do we make sure as much as we can as fallible human beings that we're doing it as well as we can?
I'd also like to thank you for the suggestion that we need maybe a place for a repository for this information heading to defense counsel, quite frankly, probably funded by OPDS. I can tell you, I hope that none of those people that said to you, I'm no longer the attorney, would have been in my office. I hope that.
You're not.
Good. Because I think that most of the dedicated public defender offices in this state would always take one of our clients back. I hope that that's true. I know I always will.
But the reality, as you know, is that the overwhelming majority of the counties are using some sort of for-profit contract system, mm-hmm. and those people are the people who have said, yeah, I'm done. This person is not my client.
That's horrifying to me. So thank you for bringing that to our attention. Okay, now I'm done, Rod.
Both Mr. Wax and Ms. Plesser, thank you for your passion and commitment to this topic. It is a steadfast position by all of us, I believe, certainly I hope and believe, that no innocent person is convicted of an offense. All the more important why my office took seriously the post-conviction policy, which Steve and Brittany, as you will remember, as we were putting together that policy, we had good, appreciated conversations to listen to your thoughts as we put together what we hoped to be a solid policy to reduce toward eliminating the possibility that an innocent person has been convicted of an offense. I take pride in, and I think, and maybe you do as well, that conversation maybe has resulted in what still may be the only post-conviction policy in the country as it surrounds safe kid examination. We haven't done a survey to confirm that literally is the fact, but we know of no other. Thank you for your addition to our work as it surrounds that. It is appreciated. As it relates to one of the point/question, our process surrounding that policy is not to conclude the process. When it goes through a review by either historically Ms. Gert or now Ms. Gardner, then on to the forensic scientist for another review, then on to a chief deputy for another review, and then we send it out to defense counsel or the defendant. That doesn't mean it's concluded. That just means those steps are concluded. the next step would be if we get recontacted, having if you think of this as a series of checks and balances, that next check and balance might be a call to the post-conviction deputy that I have the fortune of having in place to look at it from that different angle in the chance that we miss something. So I just want to, you know, I think it bears at least a comment that we don't believe it's concluded when we send the letter. It means those steps have been concluded. Question as it relates to, and maybe I'll jump off of what Ms. Horn said relative to OPDS, and it's just surrounding this conversation of who should, for example, I'm going to overly summarize by saying that letter, right? That's not doing it, you know, due a respect for the importance of that information and what it may possess as it relates to what's being sent out, but relative to who it should be sent to. Are there any conversations ongoing about changing where things are for us right now, as you heard from the presentation, to somebody or some agency other than the current status? Are there conversations outside of really the ones we're having truly this evening about that aspect?
To my knowledge, no.
Okay.
We're happy to start and be a part of that conversation because I think it is important that someone who, you know, may have gone pro se, for example, will not uh-huh. have an attorney who could help them do that, and some attorneys who really just aren't being funded. And the reality is it's expensive to run an office and they just can't do it sometimes. And so mm-hmm. we're happy to start that conversation or be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we got the FBI hair analyses a couple of years ago, I spoke with Nancy Cosine and Paul Levy about this issue in that context. And I think that with Deanna's former boss in a new role, we should probably circle back to him and say, you know, hey, Lane, cough up some bucks.
I wrote his name down, Mr. Wax, reading each other's minds about revisiting that conversation as it relates to this
yeah.
topic in an effort to get it right.
Yeah.
We want to get it right.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah. Rod, you know, we hope that you heard in what Brittany said that we really do commend your policy.
Appreciate it. No, I did.
And it is wonderful that we have in this state, you know, someone who was thoughtful and realized this is an issue that needs to be addressed. Our concern is primarily you're one county out of 36, and many of the counties, while they will have fewer cases to test, just don't have the resources. And part of our concern is that some of the district attorneys may just not know what to do with the information. And we think that that's why, to have the task force as a final product perhaps recommend mm-hmm. that each district attorney come up with a policy is something that we're saying, or get the attorney general involved. And we had conversations. We appreciated sitting in your office while you were drafting the policy. It's great. It could be improved, we think, in those small areas.
That rings a bell. You said that earlier.
You know, that Brittany mentioned. And again, if the task force is going to think about drafting something for the state as a whole, we would encourage earlier notice. And I think particularly in the smaller counties that don't have the resources, it's even more important than it is in Multnomah County. We get that you've got a process that is being staffed by professionals who are looking at the total picture, and you have Susan Horman on board. You know, I don't know if out in Lakeview or Ontario they're going to have the ability to do that, get the notice out sooner, and hopefully we get to a better result or the same result more quickly.
That's a strong reminder of I don't know that's a resource that we worked with Lane County and Marion County to assist, as you may have heard, right,
yeah.
relative to the providing of the policy that we generated, hoping that they would adopt it and do some of the legwork. It's a reminder to make sure that we can do, resource-wise, what we can do to assist those points and concerns that you raised. So thanks again.
So a couple of young ladies in the back, would you like to say anything? We're a pretty flexible group here. Thank you for being here. Thank you for taking the time. Appreciate it. Anybody on the dais? We good? I want to applaud Josh. I saw him earlier, and he commented that he was really jazzed about this particular task force meeting and what came forward to us. So I want to appreciate that. This has been truly a very, very good task force tonight. So, or yeah, now it is tonight. So thank you with that. I will adjourn.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.